seen to have a positive effect on the long-term health of recipients. So, as far as I'm aware, that's the only study that's really looked at that aspect of homeoprophylaxis. And so that's the only evidence that I can talk about when we talk about is homeoprophylaxis safe energetically, and the answer is, I think, yes, very clearly.
What were the four types of groups again? Fully vaccinated.
There were in the research, there were four groups of children. One group was fully vaccinated. The other group used HP. The other group used constitutional prevention, and the fourth group did where the parents did nothing at all, any of the above, to try and prevent infectious diseases. Is that clear?
Yes, thank you.
Good. Okay, so if we move on to the evidence base of effectiveness, I generally nowadays break that up into four groups of evidence. So the first group relates to historical evidence. So this is basically clinical records that have been collected in our literature. And the first one, of course, was Hunneman's publication of his essay, The Cure and Prevention of Scarlet Fever, which he published in 1801. But it related to his experience in 1798 using a potency of belladonna to both treat and prevent scarlet fever. And so that was the first time that HP was used, specifically to prevent people getting a targeted infectious disease. And then when you look through our literature, you can see the early masters like von Bonninghausen and Kent, right through to the present day, used HP. So we have a significant body of evidence, but it's not evidence that gives us a measure of effectiveness. So the second group of evidence that I look at is the short-term use of HP, where people have actually collected data. Now, on my website, and if some of you don't want to take notes, then you can click onto my website later on. It's 3 W's HomeStudy, HomeStudy.net. And I've got a summary of this on the website because, you know, we know HP is safe. The crucial thing is, does it work? Because there's no point using something that's safe if it doesn't work. So this second group, probably the best example in English that I'm aware of was the use of the nosode of meningococcal meningitis type B in Brazil in 1998. And this was published in Homeopathic Links by Moninsky and others. And they immunized homeopathically over 65,000 children in this particular region of Brazil where there was an outbreak of meningococcal meningitis. And there were about 23,000 children in the region who weren't homeoprophylactically covered. And so they actually, it was a great study. It wasn't a trial, it was actually a practical intervention. And I should just divert for a moment and say, one criticism of the evidence base is that we don't have a lot of randomized controlled trials. In fact, most of the evidence that we do have is from practical interventions designed to save people's lives. So, you know, it's not as though this is a study set up under laboratory conditions. These are practical interventions in the real world, and most of them don't have control groups. It just so happened this one in Brazil had a perfect control group because people in the area lived fairly communally, and so the people running the hospitals in the area who were homeopathic doctors, if someone got meningococcal meningitis, they would have been the first point of call. So they were the perfect people to collect the data, and they had this wonderful control group. So they followed the two groups of children for 12 months. The efficacy was around 95% after 6 months, and it was around 91% after 12 months. And that's a fantastic result because, well, at that time, apart from the Cubans, who were the first to invent or produce a meningococcal meningitis type B vaccine, there wasn't one available. In fact, in Australia, we've only just recently started using a vaccine here for meningococcal meningitis type B. Of course, that's only because the Australian government wouldn't trade with the Cuban government, which is just pig-headed stupidity. But anyway, that's another story. But when you look at the other interventions that we have data for, the short-term intervention, the important fact is that they all come in at around the 90%, whichever the country it was conducted in, whatever the disease was for. There is consistency at around that 90% effectiveness mark. And that consistency is very important because some of the studies are quite small, some of them, most of them, don't have effective control groups. But when you get enough information from studies coming in from a big variety of sources, and the data is all saying a very similar, reaching a very similar conclusion, that actually gives strength to the data. We don't need randomized controlled trials to get, be able to make effective practical conclusions. And to be honest, there's a huge amount of evidence out there now showing that what we get from randomized controlled trials is actually much less reliable than is portrayed. And you just need to look at work by Professor John Ioannidis, for example, who has done some excellent work. His first major publication in this area was in 2005, where he wrote an article, Why Most Research Findings Are False. And for those of you who are interested in evidence, if you're not familiar with his work, I would highly recommend it. And he's written some fantastic stuff. By the way, he doesn't like natural medicine very much. So that, to me, makes him an even better reference to use, because it's not as though it's a naturopath or a homeopath saying this. It's a professor of medicine who's an expert in epidemiology who's saying this. So we don't have to be ashamed about our evidence base. But that's the second type of evidence. The third type of evidence is data from long-term use, and this is where my own research from 1986 to 2004, my own data collection, comes in. My single-figure measure was 90.4%. This is for long-term prophylaxis. And when I looked at the three individual diseases for which I could get readings, in other words, for which there were failures, there weren't any failures in the other diseases, so that was whooping cough, measles and mumps, then the efficacy worked out for the individual diseases was all around, once again, the 90% mark. So there's consistency where we have evidence between short-term prophylaxis and long-term prophylaxis. And then the fourth and final type of evidence that we have is what I was talking about earlier from Cuba and India. And this is practical interventions by government in millions of people. And in a way, you know, I've been involved with HP since 1985. But for me, the last decade has really brought to the fore evidence and the volume of evidence that we've never had before. And it's been very heartening because there's now really irrefutable data in substantial bodies of people in interventions conducted by orthodox medical practitioners and orthodox scientists, some of the doctors of whom are also homeopathic doctors and some aren't. Dr. Braccio and Dr. Camper, who led the interventions in Cuba, were not homeopaths. So
yeah, I think we lost him.
Yeah, I think that was him that got disconnected.
Oh.
It's
hope he comes back. Does anybody remember the first and second types of evidence? What he had?
Yeah, historical was the first one.
Okay.
And short-term use was the second one.
What was that physician's first name that he was talking about? Why most research? The epidemiologist.
I didn't catch the names.
Von Boyninghausen?
No, he was an expert in epidemiology, not a homeopath.
Oh, I didn't catch his name.
I think he said it was on his website.
Right.
See it on his website.
Yeah. Oh. I would have liked to hear why he feels there's such a divide among homeopaths about homeoprophylaxis.
Yeah, me too.
Well, Myra, I myself have heard it from a lot of homeopaths. They've said that giving a homeoprophylaxis would weaken the vital force and give you more of an apt chance to catch the disease where others wouldn't. And I had a problem with that answer, but, you know, as I believe in homeoprophylaxis. But there's still a lot out there.
What about that it's not treating the totality of symptoms because it's not treating a symptom?
I don't mind the idea of a prophylaxis, whether it's the nosode or the genus epidemicus, when something is present. What I'm not very excited about is giving these prophylactic remedies in a regular way, whether that's annually or more than once a year, when there isn't any evidence of that disease present.
Yeah.
Well, that would be an interesting question to ask.
And
I wonder... He didn't email me. Maybe I should email him real quick.
Yeah, I think so. And say, "Ooh, you dropped off. Can you call back in?"
Maybe he's talking away.
Right. Maybe he doesn't know nobody's there. Yeah, email.
Hello.
Him. Hello.
Can you hear?
Are you back?
Hello. No, this is John
Mumbleton. Oh, hi, John. We've lost Isaac.
I know. I think you should just join up again. Just send him an email and tell him that
yeah, that's
not
what she was saying.
Yeah, I am.
That's what she was just saying.
Yeah, I wanted to... I have some concerns about homeoprophylaxis as well, and I wanted to talk to him about this in this meeting. I think there's a place for homeoprophylaxis and an idea of a genus epidemicus when symptoms are present, but I think it's...
Yeah, I just said the same thing. That's what we want to ask him about at some point.
I'd
be interested to hear.
But I think also, you know, is it okay if I ask another question or two?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. We don't have Isaac to answer, but...
I want to ask what you're doing here, and I'm going to ask Isaac about this. I mean, I think that, you know, politically, whatever the clinical scientific... reliability of the usefulness of homeoprophylaxis. We've got a really significant political problem in credibility in terms of proving what we've achieved with homeopathy in clinical situations. And it's very hard to prove what we presented.
But he was just, were you online for the last 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Well, he may have said all those things, but still he doesn't, just because there are a collection of things that add up to 90% doesn't mean that there are the usual accepted randomized controlled trials. So he can say it looks good. He's still not saying how many countries are actually accepting.
Well, I mean, when
right now it just seems like India and Cuba was.
Well, he's talking about, I mean, there are some studies and there's some broad things, but the idea of trying to gain acceptance for...
Oh, it's Isaac back again. Is anyone still there?
Yeah, we're here, man. We're here.
Did you hear?
Oh, good, you're back.
Oh, did you hear what I was saying about the evidence base?
Some of it.
We stopped you where you were saying that practical interventions
interventions by governments have brought forward the volume of evidence and a substantial intervention.
And then it cut out after that, did it?
Yes, and then we had a lively discussion with lots of questions to ask you.
Okay, look, well, I'm glad I rang back then. My wife actually made me ring. I sort of when I realized there was no one at the end, I thought, I said a few very inappropriate words and thought, that's it. But she said, no, you've got to ring back. So there we are.
Yeah.
Thank Anita for getting me back. So would you like to ask the question?
Yes, let's ask our questions to Isaac, now that he's back.
May I ask one? Isaac, this is John Melnichuk. I'm in Palo Alto, California, in America. Hello? Yes, yes. And my question is, whatever the clinical utility of homeoprophylaxis, and I think there's a narrow usage for it, where there are symptoms are present, and you can give a remedy on the basis of symptoms present in the community, like a genus epidemicus kind of situation. I have a question about the difficulty with which the homeopathic community has in proving clinical efficacy of what we've resolved beyond what we've prevented. Can you speak to that?
Well, I'd like to speak to the first part of your question, which I quite strongly disagree with, actually, because that's a really important point. So something like whooping cough that's not epidemic but is present, would you agree that we should try and prevent that or not?
I think we should treat it when it presents clinically.
We should what, sorry?
I think we should... my opinion is that we should treat it when it presents clinically.
Right. So this is the first point of disagreement. So you're saying that you're quite happy to treat whooping cough in a 1 or 2 month old baby, and I'm saying I'd rather prevent whooping cough in a 1 or 2 month old baby because it can be fatal in infants of that age. So this is an immediate differentiating point in the discussion. And by the way, I didn't mention this time, I think I mentioned it last time, that some colleagues and I from the from Federation University Australia did an international survey on HP, which has been published in Homeopathic Links in a couple of editions, and about 10% of the respondents actually said that they would prefer to treat disease rather than prevent it. Although when we actually looked more carefully at the full responses from those people, about half of them actually used HP when it came to the crunch. But it means about 5% of practitioners said that no, they don't want to prevent disease, infectious diseases, they'd rather treat them. And so this is a real differentiating point right at the beginning. And so with serious diseases like whooping cough in infants, meningococcal meningitis, I mean, I would much rather prevent someone getting meningococcal meningitis than having to try and treat it, because they can be dead in 24 hours if you don't get it right, and probably even if you do get it right, they still may die. So, you know, I think that's something that people need to think about seriously. But sorry, to the second part of your question...
Can I respond to that?
Of course.
Okay, great. I think that, I'm living here in California, and there's in the media, very frequent media warnings about the devastating effect of whooping cough in our community. And last year in the state of 35 million people, there were 2 deaths from whooping cough, as far as I know. So
for sure, it was whooping cough.
Well, that's what was reported, I think, by the offices of public health. So, for me, the question of blanket vaccination, whether by homeopathy or by the medical authorities using pharmaceuticals, I'm questioning whether some of the alarm that is generated in public is actually warranted. And that comes into my thinking about, well, if there's a problem, then treat it. If there's not a problem, don't treat it. That's part of my thinking, actually.
In a similar vein, it's one thing if there is an epidemic that we know regularly is occurring, like Cuba with leptospirosis. Then it seems really appropriate. But for something like whooping cough, which the whooping cough that went around was easily treated with a remedy in so many clients, but if it's going to cause them harm to take it ahead of time, why would I want to cause harm if they might never catch it? And it's so easily treated when it is.
Well, if you're a better husband,
do that regularly on every year because of this hypothesis that this disease is out there and 4 cases in the state, you know, bigger than most countries, is an epidemic. That's not an epidemic.
Our experience in Australia is very different. We have had many hundreds of cases of confirmed whooping cough, and a few children have died, and many young infants have ended up in hospital because most of the children who get it are not treated by homeopaths necessarily. You know, look, I've treated hundreds of cases of whooping cough, and if you get the right remedy, we all know that homeopathy can be very successful. A lot of the people I have to treat, because Australia is a big country, and not in or near a major city, and treating at a distance when you can't actually see the patient renders it more problematical. We know from the research that an appropriate HB program is not going to be dangerous. So my question is, why would you, if the parents want to try and prevent the disease in the child, why should we tell them no, let your child get the disease and then we'll treat?
Well, it would be more like what you're saying is that whooping cough happens to be something that's really present in Australia right now. And we're seeing it so consistently that either here's a genus epidemicus and without side of having that, let's use HP. But it's because whooping cough is so present in that particular society. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily there in all societies, just like we wouldn't think of taking leptospirosis every year because Cuba had leptospirosis.
Oh, totally. And what are you really suggesting, that I think we should take HB for everything?
Well, I know that what I've heard
from
many other people on the HP issue is, and some of the illustration has been from South America, is a regular use of homeopathic prophylaxis for a wide variety of childhood diseases, and it's taken every year or more than once in a year on an annual basis.
Yeah, well, okay, that's a fair comment, and people have to make their own minds up as to what is both indicated and what the parents' concerns are about. In my own program in Australia, my main program covers only 5 diseases, and there are many more vaccines, of course, and I am prepared to offer HP for many other diseases if the parents particularly want me to, but I only look at 5 diseases, and the ones that I look at, and this is for infants, whooping cough, meningococcal disease, pneumococcal disease, Haemophilus influenzae, and tetanus. And tetanus, of course, is not likely to be a problem until the child gets a bit older. But those other ones are not in epidemic proportions, but they are circulating in the community. And they all can be potentially serious for young children. But my bottom line usually is that I'm very happy to listen to parents' concerns. Now, if someone comes in and said they want HP for rubella, I would say to them, well, you know, rubella is the mildest of all the childhood diseases, and really it's much better if your child gets the disease. That's the best way to build up immunity. And most parents would actually accept that. But there's a few who don't. And so then the next question becomes, if we have a request from a parent, do we deny it or do we go along with it? I don't feel that uncomfortable going along with it, given that I know from the evidence we have that there's not likely to be any damage